Hello, everyone. My name is Frederick Gieschen, and today I'm joined by my dear friend Tom Morgan, who writes a publication called The Attention Span at the KCP Group. I read every one of his publications every Sunday. We're talking about believability, resonance, finding flow, selling research, profits in the modern age, everything. It was a very personal conversation for me and for him, and I really hope you find some value in it, some interesting ideas. As always, we're not talking stocks, but again, whether it comes to stocks or life advice, take everything with a grain of salt. We're not your personal coaches or investment advisors. I really hope you enjoy this conversation, and on we go. All right, Tom, thank you so much for joining me today. This is I've been waiting for this to finally pick your brain. And I want to start with one of your most recent pieces. You talked about integration and sort of this journey from, especially in the investing world, but I guess in other domains too, where people find somebody and in the beginning it's their guru, then they discover all the flaws, they discard it, and maybe they arrive at some point of integration. Tell me a little bit about that piece and how you think about that journey.
Yeah, well, actually, it's a fun place to start because you inspired it, which was that basically I realized that it's a pretty stupid character flaw of mine that basically almost everyone should have something in them that is of value, right? And even on Wall Street, like there was the old joke that if someone's wrong 100% of the time, they're a perfect contra, right? Like, and if you're telling me, and I did this all the time, there are certain like thought leaders, investors, gurus, you're seeing them, you know, literally blow up in controversy every single week on Twitter, and you watch the whole like information sphere discard that person because they got into a topic that was unacceptable or they did something that was unacceptable, and they just basically get wholesale canceled. And whenever I see that now, I'm just like, oh, you're not exercising discernment. You don't have enough self-confidence to say, there's something in here that's valuable and there's something in here that's idiotic. And I'm actually able to determine what those things are. And I don't need someone else to tell me what that is. Because, you know, as we both know on Wall Street, negativity sells better and sounds smarter. And if you can say, well, you know, actually this guy, everyone loves him, but you wouldn't realize that he got this huge call wrong in 1995 when he nearly lost all of his money and yada, 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 right? Like you sound very smart doing that. But if you can say, as like the real master investors can, actually you should realize that this guy's value is in X. And I sat down with a really smart PM and I brought the CIO of a hedge fund into him. And at the end of it, he was like, this guy thinks he's really good at exponential tech, but what I think he's really good at is calling bottoms in emerging markets. Because he basically looked at this guy's history and he looked at how he talked about certain things. And he was like, I'd actually say where this guy is sort of believable is not necessarily where he wants to be believable. And so what you're saying is that when you can take it to sort of the master of the game level, you're able to pick and choose stuff out of people that really resonates with you. And I think the piece I wrote this weekend, well, about kind of character in investing, goes back to this awesome interview with Arnold Vandenberg that Bill Brewster did, I think in 2020, where Vandenberg talks about picking resonant ideas out of investors and then integrating them around your own character. And that's a really, really deep idea, but it also means that when things get really volatile, you have resilience because you're relying on yourself and not someone else's thesis.
Okay, let's try to unpack this a little bit because I totally agree with you, but it's also one of those things where I'm like, yes, I think you're right, but I don't know that it's always straightforward, right? So first, let's go back to this idea of believability. I really enjoyed your piece on that and sort of this idea of what a person says they're good at is not necessarily in some cases, like people don't actually have a firm handle of what it is that makes them successful. But I wonder if a very successful investor isn't able to unpack what really makes them successful, how the hell is somebody supposed to figure it out from the outside? How do you think about that question? And how to like approach it when evaluating people?
I don't know. Like, and I think that's something you'll probably have better ideas on than me, because obviously, like, there's the luck skill continuum, and no one even is really sure, like, how long a track record you need to determine whether you're actually good at it, and all the countervailing factors, and did you just get one long cycle right, and all this sort of stuff. Again, you can sort of dissect most things out of anyone's performance over you know, even a decade long time horizon. So, like, assessing believability is really, really hard in investing. I think the point I was trying to make in the piece I wrote on believability was a slightly different one, which is that expert intuition, which, again, the key word is expert. When these guys have sort of 30 years of experience, they'll make a lot of their decision making unconsciously, and then kind of give retroactive explanations as to why. And if they're in the investment world, those retroactive explanations can often be very good, and they can often believe those retroactive explanations, but that wasn't why they did it. And so I guess sort of the disappointing way to answer that question is results will show if those people are good at it, but their explanations won't necessarily do that. And what was super funny, I think I told you that piece went to the front page of Hacker News, and one guy kind of commented on, and never read the comments on Hacker News, but one guy commented on, like, this isn't the way that fund management works. No one ever makes gut decisions because it's sort of untradeable knowledge. And simultaneously, I got a guy with 28 years experience as a PM email me in my inbox being like, no, that's exactly how it works. We just can't tell people because, like, you can't tell consultants that. So you get into this really weird situation where the luck skill continuum gets blended and the ability to give retroactive explanations gets blended, and I guess results are the ultimate arbiter, but I think it's one of the great problems in investing, and I don't think I've got it figured out.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I mean, I spent 1 year in institutional consulting, right? And it's very, very interesting that, I mean, I see this in kind of all the time now, that the allocator's desire for something like for manufactured stable return, it's just like People build products around it. And I guess in the hedge fund world, sometimes it leads sort of to this obfuscation of, like, this is what we actually do, but we have to present it in a certain way such that it, you know, is a product that actually gets bought. But actually, I realized we didn't set the table. Maybe you can kind of spend a minute on your journey and sort of setting the table for how you got that exposure, right? You sometimes mention how you met some of these investment managers and, like, got that exposure. Like, just let's go back to the start for just a minute and give everyone a sense for, like, how you got that exposure and what your baseline is of seeing these people in action.
Yeah, sure. I've always sort of been a passive observer on the sidelines and the least intelligent person in a room. I started on Wall Street in 2005, messed around for a few years very unsuccessfully before that in different jobs, but was lucky to get offered a job on Wall Street. Made it through 16 rounds of interviews. I was told I was down to the last candidate, and then they decided to go with no one. But eventually got hired a few months later for a different desk at the same firm. I ended up spending about 14, 15 years selling US equity research to first institutions in London and then institutions in New York. I spent a year selling data, credit card data. And then I had, as you know, like a crushing 3-year midlife crisis where I wandered the professional desert for a very long time and sort of consumed a lot of spiritual literature and a lot of non-financial literature. And now my employers, the KCP Group, are a kind of smart wealth management group that we run $13 billion for a pretty diverse range of clients. And I explore issues that our clients are curious about and that I'm curious about, and try and meet the most interesting people that we can, like you, and try and have the most interesting conversations that we can, you know, perhaps a little bit further up Maslow's hierarchy than traditional wealth management, because I think, you know, something we can talk about a bit later, but I think the industry has moved on a little bit from that. And maybe, you know, my own crushing midlife crisis gives me some sort of, you know, direct personal experience of what people are looking for beyond the mundane, at least when they'll give themselves a little bit of time to look.
Mm-hmm. And needless to say, but I'll still say it / put it into the email, obviously, I recommend everybody subscribe to your stuff because it's excellent. I read it every week, and I always get more out of it than I can chew, frankly. But you already mentioned kind of this concept of resonance, right? And I think you, with this sort of what you described as midlife crisis, or this sort of going through a period of a break from your path before that and trying to figure out something new. I wonder, how resonance works for you. What are ideas that you pursue? How do you decide what you spend your time on? Because there is sort of this infinite amount of information, right? And there's so many ideas you could dig into. I'm just curious how you make those decisions and how you decide, like, what does resonance mean to you?
I think it's a question of limitless depth, and it's unbelievably interesting. So, like, as you know, and maybe some listeners will know, I'm like relentlessly obsessed with this thinker called Ian McGilchrist. And he wrote a book called The Master and His Emissary, which I read 2 years ago, and it changed my entire perception of the world. And he's just followed up with a masterpiece, which took him 10 years to write, called The Matter with Things. And the shorthand is that basically it's how the structure of the two hemispheres of our brain and the characters with which they interact with the world influence both our experience of the world and also the structure of our culture and society around us. I would urge anyone to read it, despite its ridiculously intimidating 1400 page length. The thing that I'm taking away from it, and there are like 50 things, but one of them, which is relevant to your question, is our exploratory attention is a better guide of our future growth than our narrow attention. And this is sort of this wild idea that is itself a sticky idea for me when I first heard it. So I was in Newark Airport in the security line, and I heard this podcast, and the speaker just says, Carl Jung had this idea that your future self directed your interests in the present to guide your growth. And I was like, well, that sounds mental, but it's also kind of interesting. And at least without believing sort of the present and future aspect to it, it is fairly well known that your right hemisphere is taking in about, you know, a million times more information, maybe a trillion times more information than your left hemisphere. And it directs your attention towards what you should be paying attention to next. And I believe that we feel the direction that we should be going in next as resonance. And so basically, if you regard the information landscape as sort of this three-dimensional field around us, we should be navigating that gradient based on how interested we are in topics around us. And so, and I think a lot of that interest is unconscious to us. So I'll give you a specific example. I believe that certain story structures transmit a huge amount of evolutionarily beneficial information. It's why you see the same story structures come up again and again and again. But if you ask people why they like those stories, they can't answer the question. Like, what's your favorite movie? It's Shawshank Redemption. Why is Shawshank Redemption your favorite movie? And you're a bit like, it's a good story, like there's some good acting, right? You can't articulate it. You don't know why it's gripped your attention, because your conscious self hasn't really thought about it. It just knows it grips your attention. And in the same way that you cannot control what you're interested in. And I guess, like, without meandering around too many different directions, one thing that becomes directly relevant to people in finance is that in my own experience and subsequently, I've noticed that when people stop getting interested in things, it is signaled that there's no more growth left for them in a topic and they need to move on, either professionally or personally, onto a different thing. But because the frictions are so great, particularly in finance, people cannot move to a different thing. But your interests and what you're gripped by and what you're passionate about are much more significant in terms of directing your future growth. And so that's almost a meta comment, because that idea was resonant to me. And also it has directed my future growth in a lot of very strange ways.
Yeah, I think this is such an interesting topic, because there is what you just described, right? You have sort of this exploratory attention, and maybe you feel this little tug like, oh, this thing is interesting, right? And you on one level, maybe you realize that, oh, I should spend more time with this. So it's like, you know, keep track of this thing. But then there's all these other influences, right? And I'm thinking primarily like social, right? Like here's this thing that's maybe interesting, but there's also my Twitter feed. And like, oh, here are all these things that are getting a lot of attention from other people. And so those must be interesting, right? Like there's a million ways to get, at least that's how I experience it, to get pulled away from what resonates with me. And I think it's for two reasons. It's for that
sort of that social redirection, right? Like the mimetic desire. And I know you hate that term, but like kind of just the interest in what other people are interested in and maybe desire to have that too. And also fear in terms of, oh, if I'm pursuing this direction, I'm going to have to leave something behind and give something up. And the friction you just, or this cost of making any kind of change. And I'm wondering how you think about that now, sort of a few years in retrospect. And then there's a bunch of other things that we should touch on that kind of all, that's what I love about everything you do. Like everything is connected. Like there's just.
Well, here's another connection that I think answers that question and illustrates another point that's been enormous for me, which was something that I tweeted about last weekend, which is this Moloch and Slack, right? Twin essays by Scott Siskind. They're both super crazy long. Meditations on Moloch is definitely the scariest thing I've ever read. And sort of the TLDR is effectively Moloch is what happens when any system targets something abstract. And by abstract, it just means, you know, human created, money, power, engagement algorithms, right? And anytime you target something implicit for its own enjoyment, things go really well, right? And your life unfolds in this beautiful synchronistic way, but everything has to be done for implicit enjoyment. So it's something that you and I talk about a lot, right? Which is motivations, right? Like, if we're following something we're intrinsically interested in, we'll tend to get engagement as a byproduct. But if you're tweeting for the purposes of getting engagement, often that can backfire as a business model and as a way to live your life, because you're targeting the abstract thing. And I think that concept is applicable to sort of everything, right? Because the reason why people get stuck in these holes is because they've targeted something abstract, and there's never any life in the abstract thing, right? I'm not saying it's bad to care about money. Money is essential, but if money is the only thing that you target, eventually there will be no life, right? It's very unlikely that you will live a fulfilled life as a byproduct of pursuit of money, but it is very likely that you will get money as a byproduct of the pursuit of a meaningful life. And it doesn't really matter how much money you get if your life is truly meaningful, right? As long as you have a certain amount. And now I know that can sound a little bit idealistic, and I'm not saying the balance is easy. In fact, the balance is probably the hardest thing you can ever do, and staying on that beam is on the hardest thing you can ever do. But it is amazing that you can basically apply Moloch on one side and Slack on the other, although you could, you know, Slack is a terrible word. All the words for the other thing are awful. They're like, you know, love or the Tao, the path, the universe, life itself. You know, all of these things, they're all nonsense words because they're trying to encapsulate something that cannot be abstracted, right? You cannot make that word into an abstract thing. You just have to think of it in different ways, which again goes back to everything that we've just been talking about, which is that resonance, right? You know when you're pursuing that thing because it's resonant and because you feel meaningful, it feels meaningful. And so when you're directing your own attention around the internet, Moloch is everywhere, basically being like, here, look at a pair of boobs. You know, like, here, look at some Twitter beef that's irrelevant. Here, look at something that is not self-directed attention. I mean, it's fine to do it occasionally, right? But it's not self-directed attention. And I think the difference is how you feel when you consume it. That, like, when you're going down a rabbit hole that is growing you, it feels challenging and meaningful. But when you're just doom scrolling, you feel like crap.
Yeah. Yeah. It's sort of the difference between being in the flow of an activity that's challenging to just the right extent, right, where you're growing without being completely overwhelmed, versus binging on potato chips and just sort of having a good time in that moment, and then coming out of that sort of that dream state and be like, wait, what did I just spend an hour doing? And it's just sort of, it's almost like you wake up out of trance.
That I want to say something here, because I had an insight last week that maybe is like super obvious, but had never really occurred to me in this way before. So one, like, the passage of time is a way that you navigate the 3D gradient, right? When you're exactly on your flow, you move at the same speed of the as the world. So it feels like time is not passing because you're moving at the same speed as the world. If you're out of your flow, time feels like it's grinding, right? Like when you're really bored and you're not engaged in something, time flows really slowly. And when you're like way out in the right hemisphere, time just feels like it's moving super crazy rapidly. And there's all these really weird accounts of how that feels. The most desirable thing is to be like exactly on the center line. And almost everyone knows when they're on the center line because they just have this intrinsic feeling of meaningfulness, which we describe as the flow state. And what's I spent a long time kind of obsessed with the flow state. And Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi wrote that book that everyone's read. And in the West, people interpret it as like a performance tool that you use flow to become a better tennis player or a better trader. And it's your it's peak performance, right? And then I was listening to this lecture from John Vivekie, who I'm interviewing for work later this week. And there was something that came to me, and it was basically the shaman is a guy in a community, but you can use, you know, hero, prophet, comedian, visionary, entrepreneur for the same term. And it's someone who uses the flow state to go into a different experience outside of the existing paradigm and see something else. So the example he gives is something called soul flight, which is when the shaman would get themselves into a trance state and they would experience the world from above, and it would give them a completely new framing on an issue. And then they could come back and speak to the rest of their tribe in a way that would heal them and reorient them back in the right direction. And Vivekie is like, that's what a prophet is. A prophet doesn't predict the future. A prophet just goes back to everyone and says, guys, you've gone off course a little bit. Here's where the Tao is, right? Here's where the meaningful thing is. I'm going to show you guys where it is. And the thing that kind of blew me away, because I'd never thought of it this way, is people that spend more time in flow are more likely to have insights that allow them to reorient their life in the right direction. So Vivekie says, like, the more time you spend in flow, the more of an insight cascade you have, right? The more insights you have, the better you are at calibrating your life towards that meaningful thing, right? It's kind of a really weird idea, and I hadn't really thought of it that way before. Does that make sense?
It does. You know, it's one of those things, I think I picked this up from you, where it's like, this makes sense, and I've never heard somebody before articulate it this way. But now that I've heard it, I'm like, yes. However, it can lead one to say like, oh, okay, so I just need to max out my time in flow, right? So I'm going to optimize my morning routine and everything I do and go back to exactly what you just described. And I'm going to use flow in this, not in an indirect way, but in a direct way. Like, I just want to get into the flow state. I'm going to manipulate my environment or my work, like whatever I do, I'm going to restructure it to an extent to maximize the flow, and then everything will be great. And you come back to like using it as this abstraction, this tool, right? And like, isn't that the danger of like, it's sort of this like trying without trying idea. Like, once you tell me that it's good to try without trying, or once you tell me it's good to have flow, I'm going to try to do it. And with that intentionality, I'm going to wreck the whole, like, is that, what do I do with this idea? You know, I like it, but like, what do I do now?
That's so insightful. And it makes me think of Pixar's Soul, right? Like, have you seen Pixar's Soul? Oh, it's great. Like, it's the kind of movie you could only make now, because it's like, it's just raw existentialism. And I can't believe that they made that movie for kids, right? But basically, the big theme is that the main guy is a very talented jazz player, and he gets, I don't want to spoil the movie for people, but he gets his big shot playing jazz, and it's this transcendent experience. And halfway through the movie, he goes into sort of this other realm, and one of his guides says, here's the area of lost souls, the people that haven't found meaning in life and they haven't found their flow, but also people that get addicted to flow get lost in here as well, right? The people that spend all of their time in the zone and are just bliss junkies, just chasing it, they get stuck here as well. And at the end of the movie, he has this peak experience performing jazz, and he walks out, and there's Dorothea Williams, this jazz singer who's recruited him off the street to have his like life-changing moment. And he says, well, what happens next? And she says, well, we come back and do it tomorrow. And he kind of gets broken by this idea, in that, like, this is a bad answer to a question, but it's sort of way I'm thinking about it, which is that, you know, the thing that, that Jim and you talk about, which is human adulthood, right? You're using these things to become a more engaged and adjusted adult. You're using them as sort of mechanisms to get more present. You don't want to be chasing the experience for the sake of the experience itself. And it reminds me of something, an insightful philosopher I spoke to recently. He was like, the dangers with like the psychedelic movement in America right now is people are going to start worshiping the plants and the experiences that they provide rather than the insights that they get from them. And so like, I don't know how you get out of that trap where it's like, am I just using this to get addicted to the insights that I get from flow? Am I using flow to become a visionary? Like, it's, I don't know how you, I don't know how you close that paradox.
Yeah. No, I think as soon as you start to go down the mental path of I'm going to use this as a shortcut and I'm going to use this as a tool and I'm going to abstract it away from what it used to be, right? It was maybe a ceremony or some, like if I'm writing, I mean, sometimes I get into, and so this is actually another thing where it's like, I know there are certain things I enjoy doing that sometimes you get into flow and there's like, okay, I'm working on a piece and like I get into flow state and like this really just, it just flows, it just works. And, but it's not always like that. And sometimes it's the opposite. It's a total grind. And I haven't figured out how to be consistently, you know, in the sort of the better, on the better track or the more flowy track. And it, and I still sort of have to come to terms with that because it's like, you could then say like, oh, does that mean, you know, I think there's this worship of like, now, like you're identifying with your occupation and with your job. And that means it always has to be fun. You always have to find fulfillment with it. And I think I pretty much subscribe to that where I was like, no, I want to do this thing. And it's got to be, you know, it's got to be the thing that fulfills me. I'm that person who does that thing and like really identify with it and then kind of expect it to lead to that flow state. Like, quote unquote, like I'm a writer now. And that means writing for me leads to flow state. And like, if it's not like that, and if it becomes a grind, then you sort of start to doubt the whole thing. Like, wait, am I on the wrong track? Should I be, you know, doing something entirely different? Should I just be a dog walker? Like, I love dogs, like maybe go in a different direction. So I feel like once you start, you know, worshiping the plants, or like once you get into that mindset, or like get, you elevate this state to, you know, I don't know. I this is maybe me long in a long-winded way of saying, like, I struggle with the same idea.
This ruined my life. Right? This whole idea ruined my life decisively for very many years, which was that basically I had an intellectual understanding of all of these things, but my intellectual standing got in my way, understanding got in my way, right? So I left Wall Street in, I think, 2017, started my crisis, and I said that for my second act, it needed to be something meaningful. So I went to Fordham to study social work. I looked into being a union analyst. I looked into being a psychologist. I became a coach. You know, I started a coaching company. All of it was based on what I wanted to do, which was help people in stuck spots. But every time I tried to do something, the door would slam shut in a really like devastating way. Things would not work out for me. And I was also not intrinsically interested in any of these avenues. I was just telling myself I was because they were meaningful. So I was saying this is meaningful because obviously it's meaningful to be a social worker, but it wasn't actually interesting. Those textbooks were killing me, right? But I was holding the wheel too tightly because I was trying to redirect myself into something that was obviously meaningful. And it was only when after a series of like catastrophic failures and massive, massive depression that I basically gave up and started just doing things for intrinsic benefit and intrinsic pleasure that my employers found me and this role found me. And the last year of my life has been inexpressibly fun, challenging. Like, it's, as you know, it's not fun writing, right? Anyone, someone said to me, if you're having fun writing, you're not a writer, right? Like, it's attritional, but it's still, the worst advice I've ever heard is grind it out, right? There's a subtle difference between grinding it out and being in flow. Flow does not mean bliss, right? It means something that's intrinsically challenging where time passes quickly. Or at least you don't notice the passage of time, right? Grinding it out is like a death match. And like, I think you have to be sensitive to that gradient, because that is sort of a better indicator of where you should be headed. The problem with all of this is overthinking will destroy it. And I found that out to my detriment. So you get in this awful paradox where it's like, don't think of an elephant, don't think of an elephant, don't think of an elephant. Try not to control your life. And yet when you're in a horrible dark hole, being told that you shouldn't control the direction of your life is paralyzing. And trying to control it too much is paralyzing. So like it is it like, you know, if anyone's listening to this that is in that situation, I can't make light of it because it is probably the worst experience of your life. But it is true that that information gradient and aiming towards things that you love is a potential clue as to the way out.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, I'm kind of running this experiment in real time, right? Where I'm like, everything that you describe sounds like that resonates. I'm like, you know, I'm trying to like make a living as a writer, and like that's not very straightforward. And then coming out of that not straightforwardness, there's always this balance of like, sometimes I'm like, oh, I just gotta grind, just gotta keep at it. Like, you know, you have to just keep going. And there's all these motivational quotes and all that stuff. And you're like, okay, just have to be persistent. And then there's also the flight instinct of like, what you're doing is madness. And you gotta like, just, you know, you'll find the flow somewhere else. And this intense, these nights spent just like agonizing over like, you know, if I just gone insane, should I just like, you know, drop it all and do something else, and sort of finding in between there, finding some kind of flow or just some kind of direction is interesting, and comes back though, I think, to what you mentioned in the beginning, finding the thing that interests you intrinsically, where you're like, and this is maybe a kind of it always strikes me a little bit as silly, is like, oh, even if I didn't get paid for this, I'd still do it. And But if you do find things where you're just like, oh, I just always do that. I always enjoy this activity. Like, I'm always like pulling together these different ideas and writing it up, and I want to share it. I want to explain it. And then like, okay, that there's something there, and just like have to figure out how to express it, like how, in which way the world actually needs it. Right. That's the other thing. Like, just because I think something is interesting doesn't mean a lot of other people do. So I have to sort of find the overlap between myself and, I don't want to call it the market, but certainly like the market for attention.
You've stumbled on exactly the thing I was going to say next. Well, you didn't stumble on it. You know it, right? Which is that the nuance of the follow your bliss ideology, particularly when applied to young people, and the reason why it's so pernicious, is basically, if you think you're a great punk rock singer and no one wants to listen to your music, you're probably not a great punk rock singer, right? Like, or just, you should be doing something different. And I don't know how you square that over the long term, but there's this whole idea, it's about what you can do plus what the world needs. And you can't neglect either of those things, because it's a conversation, right? Your flow with the world, you have to be open to feedback from the world. And that is the biggest conceptualization that I think is missing from Western culture, is that requires vulnerability and an openness to feedback, but also an awareness to the synchronicities and coincidences that are going to show you that you're going in the right direction. And I think for me, like, referring it specifically to my own story, was that like, when I was in this highly abstracted, disembodied, hellish, depressed state, I was still writing about like spiritual concepts, but in this very kind of like jumbled, incoherent way, as I was trying to find my way through things. But also I had no resonance because I was so abstracted. So I couldn't put anything back together around truth. And everything seemed like a solution to me because I was drowning. So I was just reaching for all these different ideologies. And what happened is that the moment I assembled these ideas around something that I actually understood, that I had some intuition on, which was finance, my current employers came to me and offered me the job, right? So like, I put it out there, I sent it to my old like client distribution list, and I ended up leading to a job, right? But I was producing all this stuff that the world didn't want and still doesn't, right? Because I shouldn't be writing spiritual nonsense, because I'm not good at it. There are people that are better, there are a million people that are better at writing spiritual nonsense. The way that I see my niche, which is still evolving, and I don't think I've mastered it, is sort of finding perennial concepts and relating them back to investing, you know, building this Trojan horse from rationality to spirituality, right? Those are the things that are interesting to me. And I think there's an appetite for them, but just straight spirituality.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially because it's so easy to kind of find the shiny new object or something that's interesting. But just because you enjoy learning about something doesn't mean yet it rises to the level of I should also be the person who, you know, does something with the thing, whether it's writing about it or building a company around it or investing in it, right? Like some things are just, it's interesting and you integrate it. And then, you know, it's just that. What I really enjoy, I just wanted to pick something up that you just mentioned, the sort of something that you've mentioned a lot is sort of identifying universal ideas or themes across different domains and finding the ideas that kind of are recurrent in different, whether it's, you know, spiritual, philosophical domains or like that kind of rise up in kind of business and finance and just with a different jargon. And I'm curious how you go about that and whether you think there's any way to do that systematically or whether it's just reading a lot and talking to a lot of people or like what does that idea mean to you? Because I've seen you just write about it. It's like, I'm trying to find these ideas that recur across different disciplines. And those are the important ideas. What does that mean? And like, how does it come?
That was always what interested me in college. So I was really bad at most things, but I was quite good at what back then was called politics, which was basically looking at systems of government and the way that people behaved and incentive structures. And I was good at sort of looking at all the patterns and connecting dots and identifying sort of overarching themes. And then when I got a job in finance, the way that research sales worked back then and still kind of works is that you get 50 to 100 emails every morning from your analyst team. And then you have to call your clients and relay the most important insights from those 50 to 100 emails, knowing that everyone else on the street is doing the same thing at the same time. So it has to be relevant to your clients. It has to be what the world needs, right? Like it is sort of weirdly, it's coming to me now. It is kind of this Taoist combination, right? It has to be what they need and it has to be what you're interested in. And so you're kind of finding this synthesis at the same time as being able to gauge market demand for something, which is really weird because this has only occurred to me as it's coming out of my mouth. But what it started off for me is as I would just write an email where I would list all of the insights that came out of our firm. So there was this early pattern recognition for what does a hedge fund guy find interesting? And then you've got this sense of resonance when the way the analyst is speaking right now, he really knows this. He really gets it. And he's maybe seen something or heard something that gives him an intuitive sense when something's going to change. And then if you're really respectful with your client's time and you communicate that to them, you develop this reciprocal relationship that moves beyond sales because you're adding value to their process, right? You're not selling them anything. You're showing them something that's of intrinsic worth to them, which is another distinction we can talk about. But it's something I feel quite strongly about in sales. It maybe doesn't make me a great salesperson. And then basically, like after my crisis, during the previous years, I got better at integrating ideas from other sources into that work, and it became more than just my bank's research. And then after the crisis, I've moved to sort of a more synthesis stage where I get all the ingredients that I've assembled from my career to date and from inhaling the internet, and I'm trying to synthesize them all into something that communicates something of reasonably lasting value. Because if you're just talking about market moves that week, that's a massively commoditized piece of information, and I'm not very good at it, right? And so it's sort of leaning into what I felt I was good at, which was pattern recognition. But all pattern recognition is fundamentally creative. Another word that I absolutely despise. But basically, the act of synthesis is fundamentally creative. You're bringing something new into the world that was not there before because it's a completely new combination of ideas. And the world will respond to that if it's useful and if it's true. And that sort of is what I'm still trying to do with like varying degrees of success.
Okay. So there's too many strands for me to like mentally follow them all right now. But like, let's start with kind of identifying the lasting value and what you just said, sort of the intrinsic value, like rather than trying to sell somebody, rather than being like, okay, you got to read this thing. Like I'm trying to push you on this, like, and you've you've said this before in a different context, but you said like you're interested in finding information with the highest ROI. And I think it's sort of the same idea, right? Like you're getting 50 emails. Here's 50 analysts. Everybody has an idea. And it's your job, without being able to spend, you know, days on it, to figure out which of these has sort of lasting value, which of these are like, how do you, I'm not even sure. I think I would get completely lost in trying to like dive into the details, but it strikes me now that it was the perfect training for what you do now.
Yeah. It's like those things that only make sense looking backwards, right? Like, it's super weird. And I all these like really deep thinkers that I've run into, they're always like, yeah, my life made no sense until I looked at it backwards. Now I realize it's like this perfect trajectory, which isn't much comfort when you're in a transition space. Trust me. It's the same concept again, which is the idea of the profit, right? So like the worst sales situation, having been in it, right? Well, the best sales situation is when you're selling something you know is true, you know your client needs, and you know will add value to them. Then it is the best job in the world because your conscious and your unconscious are aligned. You know you're speaking the truth and you know you're adding value to the other person and you are in conversation with them, right? The worst job in the world is when you have no alignment with what you're selling, right? You know the other person doesn't want it. You know you're completely out of integrity and it will eat your soul. So you are doing the same job. Notionally, you're in sales, right? But everyone that's done a sales job knows when you're selling something you know no one else needs, like even if you manage to successfully sell it, you feel like crap because you're like, I brought something of no value into the world. And it's like this guy that's the prophet, that he's gone outside of the system. He's gone into flow a lot, whatever you want to call it. He's seen the stuff that's actually true and of value because it resonates, right? So when I heard the analyst speak and I knew what the analyst was saying was true, or likely to be profitable, or wildly different from what everyone else was saying in the market, I had enough reps that I could pick that up and communicate it. And I'm not saying it was right. I'm not even saying it was always true. It just has a higher return than other things. And that, again, is sort of like this. It's this thing that, like, to fund manager performance, you can't articulate it afterwards. But something you and I were talking about before we started recording is the idea of how things sound.
Yeah. This was, by the way, the second time that you mentioned like, oh, the analyst sounded like X, right? Like they sound, and I'm just get into that. And like, how do you pick that up? Whether it's an analyst or somebody else, you're in conversation, you're interviewing a fund manager or an entrepreneur, like what do you look for when you're trying to like figure out whether they're in resonance or like just, cause you keep mentioning this. I'm like, how does Tom pick that up? What does that mean when somebody sounds in a way, you know, like what does that mean?
I'm not sure I'm good at it, but what I'll say is that the guys I think are good at it, a lot of them have just sat in like 3,000 management meetings. And there's this Taoist concept of DE, right? I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, which is like a person that moves completely attuned with his unconscious. He's completely aligned as an individual and he will move through the world with supernatural ease and be fabulously successful, but possibly in unconventional ways, right? We can detect those people. It's raw charisma. They're genuine. We want to be around them. And then there's the people that are out of alignment. And there's this momentary dissonance because they're lying, which, you know, in the McGilchrist sense would be the dissonance between the hemispheres, because one hemisphere routinely confabulates and lies, the left hemisphere, when it has access to less information, and the right hemisphere never lies, which was described as the most stunning finding from split brain research from one of the top researchers, right? So the idea is that if you lie, there's this momentary, like microscopic dissonance, either in your voice or in the way that you're behaving with other people. And by contrast, when someone is completely embodied, you can just hear it. And someone sent me a book, actually, my one of the partners at the fund, Tom, which was one of those books that we both agreed was like probably like 80% nonsense, but 20% there's something really to it. And it's called Sacred Sounds, I think. And it's this idea that all living things resonate at the same frequency, like 10 hertz, apart from us, because we're kind of like abstracted from this divine frequency, right? And we, our ability to abstract ourselves through abstract concepts takes us away from the flow of the life, like the Garden of Eden metaphor. It gives us this tremendous power over the world, but it abstracts us from it. And so like the idea is that the shaman had the ability to heal people by speaking to them. And there's a really interesting, like, funny moment in a documentary I was watching, again, about plant medicine, where, like, it used to be that the shaman would take the plant medicine and speak to people and heal them through speaking to them, right? And then the Westerners came down, they're like, I didn't just take an 11-hour flight to be spoken to by a shaman, give me the whole stuff, right? And they would take the whole thing themselves. But there's this crazy idea that when you're hearing a prophet or a shaman speak the truth to you, it snaps you back to that frequency, right? It snaps you back to the truth rapidly. And that can heal you because it's taken you out of alignment. And that's something that Joseph Campbell talked about that took me years to understand, which was that myths were there to harmonize the mind and body, which you could see as the left and right hemisphere. And it's this really weird idea that I couldn't contextualize for a really, really long time. But it's basically this idea that if you're told a story that reflects the outside world or reflects your own reality accurately, it brings you back into harmony with the outside world. And we can get stuck off in our heads in all these abstract concepts that have no bearing towards the truth. And we can tell ourselves stories about ourselves that aren't true at all. And it takes someone coming back to us and telling us the truth, however unpalatable that is, that will snap us back to that frequency. And I guess it's sort of a long-winded way of saying, like, you know it when you hear it. But it often sounds like a cliche, because a lot of truths are cliches, right? But when people say cliches, it just sounds like they kind of own them because they embody them.
Huh. Okay. So let me just take a step back, because I think, so first of all, I think there's sort of just having this baseline of these thousands of meetings, I think that strikes me as right. That's where the expert intuition comes in probably a little bit, right? Because, I mean, you need to have enough interaction with people that are out of alignment to recognize this slight dissonance, or maybe to recognize when people are in alignment. But the more interesting question to me is, and this is maybe particularly applicable to us, I don't know that it applies to everybody, right? But I'm not particularly religious, right? Like, I'm certainly not consulting a shaman. Like, I'm like, what is the modern equivalent? And like, you already alluded to it, there are certain people like who go outside the system, bring back an idea. But that's, leaving that aside, when you say that a shaman or like a myth or like this kind of mechanism snaps you back to the truth, right? Like, where do you find that? Where do we find that today? Because there's a lot of things that snap you, that pull you away. I think this goes all the way back to the beginning. There's a lot of things that kind of distract you and that pull you away from your intrinsic interest, right? Where there's that slight resonance, like particularly thinking about media, and there's just all of these influences and that are impressed on you and trying to get your attention. And you're like, okay, I want to go back to the truth. And, you know, when I hear somebody speak about an old myth, I'm like, oh yeah, I recognize there's something there. But when I read a book that like it, I'm not snapping back to the truth that easily, I think sometimes. So I'm like, I'm wondering, where does one find that today? Like, where do we even look for that?
I mean, that's sort of the perennial question, right? Because if you can find the answer to that question, you'll find your metaphorical salvation. I think there's there's an interesting way to think about it, which if I haven't completely alienated everyone listening so far, I'm definitely going to do it now, which is this idea that you and I have, I think, found, again, like, quote-unquote resonant, which is that a lot of other cultures locate the center of their cognition in their heart centers, in their chests, right? And probably the most interesting article I read last year was about that. And it's this sense of deeply embodied cognition in a way that has been very, very much disregarded and maligned by the West. And one of the things that McGilchrist talks about that I find incredibly interesting is that the right hemisphere has a competitive relationship with the right, and it will not hand over control. So effectively, your intellect will denigrate your bodily sensation and your intuitions because it does not want to surrender control. And so the bit where this gets really dark, I think, is that there is a physiological experience that I would have disregarded had it not been a defining feature of the last 12 months of my life, where you get a heartfelt sense for what is true. And your heart becomes quite a good arbiter of the direction you should be going in next. The rub is that I think a lot of us, for reasons I don't understand, do not have harmonious relationships between our heads and our heart. And often I think of the distance between our head and our heart as the mile of crap that Andy Dufresne has to swim through in The Shawshank Redemption. It's all our traumas, all of our protections, all the things that prevent us from seeing the world clearly. But every time I see a massive debate spring up around cancellation of people or misinformation or disinformation, all I think of is that this would not be a problem if most people were much more grounded in their own bodies and able to determine for themselves what they felt was true. So it's a really, really unsatisfying answer, because basically I think it comes down to you doing the work, however that is. And for me, it was complete self-destruction, right? The worst 2 years of my life, where I effectively let go of all the things that were preventing me from seeing the world clearly. And then now my discernment gets better with every passing month. It's still bad, right? But it gets better. And once you have that resonance, that again, you experience more as a felt sense than you do as sort of an intellectual, an intellectually pleasing moment. It's this kind of aha moment, which you feel rather than just understand. The more of those you have, the more you kind of coalesce around a series of ideas in the sort of the Arnold Vandenberg sense of you then suddenly start to integrate all these ideas and all these insights from all these different people, because you're more sure where you are in your own body.
So this is really interesting, because first of all, it completely resonates. And I do think in my own experience, so I used to be, I would say, very disconnected from my emotions, right? I'd push it all away and sort of try to be rational. And it would completely lead me astray, because then my guiding light were just these ideas. The reason I got into business or finance was just because of my dad was in the field, and I wanted to connect with him, and there were these desires. And then I'd be I want to be X person, or I want to fit into this thing. And it was all very, that part then came from the head, and I was always trying to make it work. And I couldn't figure out why, when I experienced it in real life, it was awful and not at all like I imagined it. And so I totally connect with the idea that when you try to get to that resonance, you have to have that harmony or access to how you actually feel about things, and you can't, and it's very easy to get tricked by whatever software is running right in your mind and whatever you put in there. Getting to those aha moments, I still think this is sort of, there's a nuance here, which is the recognizing this when it happens in the confusion in the busyness that is the day, right? To me, and I think you wrote about once about boundary periods and cultivating moments or periods in which that can occur. Because to me, this is sometimes it's meditation, sometimes it's taking a walk, sometimes, but it's usually something where I have to step away from the grind, so to speak, right? I'm trying to solve something on the page, or I'm tired, I'm just trying to do this. And unless I disengage, there's I can't see it. And then so tell me a little bit about how that works for you and how you think about finding these aha moments or creating space for it, or I don't know, how do you get at that? How do you get better at any of this?
So the word for the opposite of Moloch is slack, right? So when you're stuck in this relentless productivity of what you were saying, chasing something that was abstract, like the wrong goals in your life, and there's nothing wrong with that, right? We all do it. We've all done it. We all probably still do it, right? It's slack, which means that it's the ability to build 10 to 20% into your day of something that is just not related to anything else. And then you do get into this like infinite loop of like, am I doing something productive to do something unproductive, yada yada. You just have to be very focused on the fact that the thing that you're doing is for its own intrinsic enjoyment, right? Whatever that is and however dumb it is, you just have to be doing it for your own intrinsic enjoyment. And struggling through that is kind of the way to think about it. But well, for me, I kind of beat myself up for not meditating, right? And for not doing all the things that the morning routine of the billionaire said I should do. But I found that certain things work for me. Medium-based runs, where I'm not killing myself. I just get much more insights there. For me, the boundary period between waking and sleeping. So at night, I have no productivity at all. But what I do is I now assemble the ingredients. I'm like, here are the things that I would like answers to. And I think it was Edison said, never go to sleep without a request to your unconscious. And then I'll wake up in the morning, often incredibly annoyingly early at like 5 a.m., and have a bunch of solutions, all of which seem completely obvious at the same time. And so there are things that you can kind of program. But the irony of Slack, and the Greeks called this Chronos time and Kairos time. And Chronos time is Moloch, which also ironically is the other name for Moloch in these traditions, Saturn, Chronos and Moloch. They've all been equivalently the same god, the god of time. And then there's Kairos time, which is sort of the inspiration time, which you just can't control when it comes. You can create the kind of circumstances where it shows up, but you can't force it to show up because it just doesn't play by the same rules. The rub and the thing that I think is most neglected in our circle and really is, I think, really quite important, is the idea that nothing will emerge into a space that's full. Nothing grows into a space. Nothing, you know, if the womb is full, a baby will not grow into it, right? But that space is often created by a breakage, by a vulnerability. And a lot of people who I tell about my story, they're like, wow, you lived through, you know, 2 years of constant suicidal ideation. You must be so resilient now. And I'm like, absolutely not. I am not resilient at all. I am much more vulnerable than I ever was. And I feel the world much more keenly than I ever did. And I think a big reason for my crisis was having a son, something I haven't contextualized, right? But when you have a child, you make a bargain that your life is going to be destroyed if that child dies, right? You will mourn that child with the same intensity with which you loved them, right? You create a spot of vulnerability in yourself that would literally ruin your life, right? And that is the shadow side of the love that you feel for that person. And so, like, when you think about the slack in your day, that slack has to include some kind of conception of vulnerability. And that's something David White talks about a lot, but we do not talk about at all because our society does not accept vulnerability in any formal context, right? And so when you think about, like, you will not be able to take a message in from the world unless you are vulnerable and open to that message, particularly if it's a harsh message. And it's something you and I talk about all the time. It's what I think makes you a great writer, is that, you know, we joke about, like, every time we hit send an email, we're just waiting to get kicked in the nuts, right? And that's an unavoidable precondition for doing good creative work, which I think you do, right? Because otherwise there isn't enough of you in it. And so I think, like, a very long-winded answer and kind of doesn't really answer the question, but, like, when people think about slack in their day, it's sort of anti-productivity because there has to be some sort of vulnerability in there.
It means, or maybe some sort of sacrifice or some sort of, when you say, I, first of all, I totally agree with the idea around vulnerability. And I think it sort of comes back to is what you're doing meaningful? Like, are you risking something? And that doesn't have to be risking money, but are you putting something out there? If you're putting something out that feels risky, right, that means you're like, it's actually sort of meaningful to you, and it and there's an opinion there, or vulnerability there's something where, you know, yes, you could get kicked in the nuts. I actually think, at least to me, it hasn't happened that much. And I don't want to extrapolate from my personal experience to, you know, to everybody else. But I do think at least some my experience has been that well, I was going to say the internet, but it's probably just the people that read my stuff on the internet, or when there's vulnerability and it's sort of, it already sounds all wrong, when it's authentic, right? When it's without an agenda, then I think it's few and far between that people are mean about it. However, now that I say it, I'm like this, I really don't want to extrapolate from it too broadly, because I think there's a lot of other examples on the web.
But, no, I'm very comfortable extrapolating for you, because I've made a study of people like you, the good ones like you. And I found, and again, this is a cliche, but it's a cliche I believe, if you've opened your heart and are following your heart, things will work out very well for you. You cannot do it without opening your heart, because you will not be receptive to the signals that are going into your heart. But if your heart is open, it will receive those signals. And I think I mean that kind of literally, which is weird, right? But I do mean it kind of literally, like physiologically, right? There needs to be a certain openness and vulnerability to the world. And then it's the following part where you're following your interests. But that is also another macro theme, right? Which is one, you're following your interests. Two, that needs to be vulnerable. But three, the fact that you're saying that you've laid yourself open and then haven't been kicked in the nuts very often is also this core tenet of spirituality, that when you leap into the abyss of the universe, you will find out that it's a feather bed. Now, you don't want to overstate that, because the universe can also break you in a million pieces, as it did with me, right? But at the end of the day, you do discover that the ground of being is love, right? That is the thing that is guiding you, and therefore that is the ultimate experience. So, like, you need to have vulnerability, and you need to respond to criticism. But it's interesting how seldom that comes when you're being authentic. You actually get most of the criticism when you go after Moloch. At least that's what I look at creators who are obviously doing stuff for the wrong reason. They get shit on for the right reasons.
That's okay. That is so interesting, because I just realized. So first of all, I just realized, yeah, we drew sort of the line all the way back to, like, well, how do you follow your interests? Well, first you're open, and then you can actually receive the signal, so to speak. And then, yes, well, the once you have the agenda and you just follow the abstraction, you're like, I'm going to do it this way, right? Like, I have the playbook for how to get rich online or whatever, or in hedge funds, whatever. I'm doing a hedge fund because there's money in hedge funds, not because I want to solve the market puzzle. I'm like, and I need to do this, like, compulsively. No, it's because I'm going to make this money. And maybe a hedge fund is a bad example, because it's already, like, far in the, but still, like, there's probably, like, you see people succeeding in a monetary sense, where, and it's, for me, the risk is always that I'm looking at somebody, I'm like, oh, they're succeeding, they're making a lot of money, or they're getting a lot of, you know, recognition or whatever. And therefore, I look at that, I'm like, okay, so I want to learn from this. But if it's somebody who does it for purely that sort of, you know, the financial motivation, it's, you have to be careful that you don't, you know, take away a lesson or adopt something that's actually, you know, it runs counter to what you're trying to do. Like, I just feel like I have to process what you just said, because, like, it's so true that when you open yourself to the criticism and you put something out, we're like, God, I really worry about this. That's when you're not getting the negative feedback. And when you, at least when I stray from that path, I'm like, this is what people want to hear, or like, this is going to do well. That's when you're like getting to people like, you know, like, you kind of, it becomes obvious, right? Like that it's just done with the, I don't want to call it the wrong motivation, but I don't know. My language really fails me with this, but like, I'm like, well, yes.
You're trying to articulate something that cannot be articulated, which is the problem of this entire conversation, is that you have to use deeply inadequate placeholder words. But what you're talking about is all the things that we've just been talking about, right? Which is that when you watch a guy that's targeting Moloch, right? He may be fabulously wealthy, but you can tell he's hollow. Dead eyes, right? But the same person can be getting fabulously wealthy because they just love trading. They just love it. It sets them on fire. And so just saying rich man sad is unbelievably dumb and reductive, right? And because I've met people of ludicrous net worth who are just super crazy happy, because they're just following something that makes them so happy, right? Again, Moloch, Slack. When you're chasing something intrinsic, you'll never get bored of it because you're on the path. You'll never get bored. And you'll get rewarded for it one way or another. But again, like, it's the nuance that it has to be something that the world needs, right? Like, if there were no constraints on my process, every article I wrote would be like a million times more pretentious even than what I write now, and also would be like four times longer. So no one would read them and they would suck. So like the fact that I know that I work for a financial institution and I have to fold some of that stuff in helps. There is no creativity without constraints. You would not love your children if you knew they were immortal, right? Like there has to be some sort of constraint on this.
I have to get better with those constraints. I hear you, but I just think it's funny, right? Because I don't know if rich man said, is that a meme? I didn't know it, but it's very poignant. But it's true. Like I run across this all the time when I'm like, I'm writing about someone like, oh, there's something to learn from this person. Like they were very successful at X. And then you realize like, okay, but the personal life was a wreck or they did something shitty. Right. And then it becomes a balance because, well, I don't want to learn from this person how to be a dad or how to be a husband or whatever, how to have a lot of friends. Like but it also doesn't. So you could then discard that, right? And something that I loved about like Richer, Wiser, Happier was that like William made like the very conscious choice, like, okay, I'm only going to have people in this book where I admire kind of the person holistically. Like they're good at investing and then also the way they build a business and live their personal life. And like there's philosophical wisdom to their journey. And I respect that. I think it's very rare to find that. And I often find that like, well, here's this person and they're really good at this thing. And I can still... I try to take like a nuanced view. I'm like, well, there's still something to learn from them. It's just, you know, you want to just learn this one thing. And I don't know, how do you deal with that? Because I'm sure it shows up too with like other teachers, like outside the investment, like even spiritual teachers. There's a lot of people who like have something good to preach, but as a person, they're still flawed, right?
Discernment. Character, your own character, as your own character evolves, you will be able to discern what comes out of them and you will not discard as readily. And like, that is again the same principle, which is that you never, ever, ever, ever worship the prophet. Right. Think about all the times that a human has put themselves at the apex of a system and how utterly catastrophic it's been almost every single time. Like, that's why it was the divine right of kings, right? Is that like, don't worship me, worship what I represent, right? And it should only ever be the message. And not even the whole message, just the bits of the message that resonate. And I get like major cognitive dissonance from the same person saying incredibly amazing things and incredibly dumb things, often one sentence to the next, right? And that's on me, right? And like, I don't know, I think about your own parents, right? You go through this stage of like unquestionable adulation. Then when you're a teenager, you're like, oh my God, they're the dumbest people in the world. And then you just learn to integrate the best and worst of them. And it's sort of this universal feature, another one I find everywhere, which is taking something in, deconstructing it, and then reconstructing it with your own individual flavor added to it. That's a pattern that I see everywhere, and is a pattern that is crazy fractal and interesting, but it's also how we should behave towards gurus, I think.
Yeah, I'm stuck on this. I agree, and I'm stuck on this like Bruce Lee quote. It's like, adopt what is useful, discard what is useless, add what is uniquely yours. And then like you'd have to add, you know, like and integrate it all in some fashion, like make it a complete whole. But like I totally agree. And like that's frankly, that's what I enjoy about your work, where it's like you go into all these rabbit holes, you pull out the couple of thoughts out of like, you know, I don't know how long McGilchrist's book is, but it's very long. Like I'm still stuck in like the single digit percentage, right? It's like thousands of pages. And you're like, you're pulling out, like there's a lot of good ideas in there, but if you pull out a few and you connect them to something else, you're already doing quote unquote the world, but like certainly your audience, like a huge service, right? Like, and they didn't even know they wanted that. And like most of them won't read the 1,000 pages, right? And I will eventually, but it's gonna take a long time. But like just sort of that, yeah, that discernment and like just I mean, how do you think about your own function or your own occupation? Like, is it synthesis? Is it like the following the curiosity? Like, do you self describe as a writer? Like, if you had to like put a bow on it, can you do that, or like do you leave it undefined?
Not really. I do a really bad job at that. I joke I'm a curiosity sherpa, which is a term I stole from Maria Popova, who I think is the best at that job in the world in terms of synthesizing ideas from different traditions and finding universalities. Like, I woke up 2 days ago and realized what I wanted to do with my life. And I think this wonderful poem from David White, where he talks about like the point where you meet the world is actually pretty small. And most people get blinded by the fact that it's pretty large and they've got an infinite number of options. But the thing that you can do that's uniquely yours that the world needs is actually a pretty small point. You just need to find it. And I say just, finding it's like the hardest thing in the world, because often it involves destroying yourself to find it, right? Or at least destroying the ego, right? Letting that unconscious charisma flow through, you often have to get the ego out of the way and it kills you, right? At least that was certainly my experience, right? What I want to do with my life is help people out of Moloch into Slack, right? Is help people out of stuck places and into a different stage where they can get themselves out. Because I saw the wasted human potential I saw from people at the top of their fitness landscape just going around in infinite loops that couldn't get themselves out because they didn't know how to trust their hearts effectively. Like it broke me. It broke me myself in my own life, and it broke me to see it happen, particularly in finance, because that cohort gets so little compassion from anyone else because they're materially rich. But actually, they often have it harder than most other groups because they're materially rich. But what's interesting is that, like, you know, arrogantly, even though that sounds like quite a small job, and I don't think I'm going to be that good at it for a long time, you actually realize that is sort of the meaning of life, which is help people find their way out of this kind of egoic, very, very abstracted form of existence into something where they can finally co-create. And I believe that's the purpose of every human life. And in fact, that is right, left, right. So right, left, right is, so McGilchrist thinks that you take information in from the outside world on the right hemisphere, you cut it up into categories on the left, and then you place it back into its global context with the right hemisphere again. So he says you listen to a piece of music, you learn the notes, and then you play it creatively and intuitively. That's literally how you learn anything. That's the definition of intuition. You attend 3,000 management meetings, you unconsciously work out where all the patterns are, and then you gain this intuitive ability to determine what's true when you're interacting with another person. But it's also, in this sort of weird fractal sense, the trajectory of a human life, that we go through this stage where we're uncritically in the flow as children, we're completely in the moment, then we get more and more and more abstracted as we chase the wrong things, and then we break back into the flow again, but this time with a strong enough ego where we can co-create something and synthesize, and we have the skill set that we created through all the egoic nonsense in order to do something incredibly meaningful. It's the prodigal son, right? Like, it's the guy that comes back to God with the ability to do something different because he strayed away. And it's this crazy thing that once you see this right, left, right, you see it everywhere. Like Oliver Wendell Holmes says, you know, I would give not a fig for the simplicity this side of complexity, but I would give my life for the simplicity on the other side of complexity. And they say the same about enlightenment. You know, before enlightenment, the mountains are mountains. During enlightenment, the mountains aren't mountains. And then after enlightenment, the mountains are mountains again, right? It's this completely changed appreciation of the whole, which you get after a series of synthesis. And that's all I'm trying to do, is take in all of these ideas and synthesize them into something, if not totally new, easier for people to consume than like a 1400 page book.
Yeah. Wow. So first of all, I'm just going to say, like, the way you just phrased all of this was like complete alignment between what you said and like I connected zero dissonance. So I was like, this is spoken very, like, I'm like, okay, I'm super excited. And like, it's also, if that isn't the pitch that gets people to sign up, then I don't know what does, because yeah, that journey is scary, right? Like, it's the, you know, and I don't want to say the journey to enlightenment, because like, I'm not enlightened, like, that, you know, this is like, that's a big word, but like the journey from the fitness landscape, from this local peak where you are and you're doing a thing and it's kind of working, but it's not really working. And it's too scary to leave that world. And it's too, you know, you're too busy. You're kind of too shunned off, and you need somebody, I don't know what the right term is, but to show you that, hey, there are these other ideas. So there is this other path, and like, okay. And like, you don't have to, I mean, yeah, I don't know what the right term is, right? Because you don't want to like, you don't want to nudge people there. You don't want to like, people are, that there's, it's not your job to get somebody moving in any kind of direction, but you can show people what else is out there, or like, well, what else is possible, or that, hey, wait a second, like all these ancient ideas, you know, maybe you can put them into more relatable language, right? And like make it easier to access. You can highlight something and make it easier to access. Maybe that's a.
But that's the role of the prophet, right? Is that all he does is he shows you a little bit of slack, right? So what happens is you're in the wrong place, right? You're running at 100% capacity, and you're running at 100% capacity because you know if you amped it down to 20%, your life could explode, because your body would start to be like, dude, you're going in the wrong direction. You're at the top of the fitness landscape. Anything at the top of a fitness landscape just repeats the same behavior, then eventually dies. It's a true of all complex adaptive systems, right? And so what happens when you're at the top of the landscape, as it did for me, was your unconscious starts to give you signals you want to get out. But because our culture disregards them, and because of the terror that it involves, I started getting all these psychosomatic illnesses that were unsolvable. And the reason why they were unsolvable was because I needed to actually move, right? Like I needed to move away from the thing that was stressing me. What it was is often listening to a couple of things and reading a couple of things that caused that tiny little mind fracture where you're like, ah, shit, that's true, man, that's true. And it's gonna break something open. And when you hear it, you follow it because you just know it's true. And that guy showed you outside of the paradigm, and he carves that tiny bit of slack. And the problem is that, again, like I hope people understand what we mean by fitness landscapes, because I think they're one of the deepest concepts in the world. But like Moloch is the thing that drives you up to the top of the peak. It's necessary, right?
Fitness landscape.
The fitness landscape, right?
Maybe frame it for just like a second.
So a fitness landscape is like, if you imagine a tabletop, but with mountains and valleys all over it, the point of any organism is to get to the highest local, but the highest global peak. But what happens is you can get to the top of a smaller peak and then get stuck there repeating the same behavior. And so what you then have to do is go back down into a valley so that you can explore an adjacent and potentially higher peak. But the problem, as you can tell, is if it's Moloch that takes you up to the top of the peak, the evolution of cooperation that we understand as, you know, nature red in tooth and claw, what takes you back down is never going to be rationality, and it's never going to be competitiveness. It's never going to be anything that took you up to the top. It's going to have to be something radically different, which is why all turning points look irrational, and all moves involve the sacrifice of something that was very important to you getting up there. Most often money, right? Or prestige or status, right? All the things that are holding you in are typically the stuff that got you up to the top. So you have to give up Moloch one way or another to get back down into the valley, which is this really shitty moment for people because they realize they've only got a choice of two pains, right? You've either got the pain of stagnation, which I saw a lot, which is basically like, I'm in the wrong place, but I'm going to grind it out and I'm going to drink a lot, because I don't really want to have to think about it, right? And you turn into sort of this unformed human being that hates himself and everyone hates, with the dead, soulless eyes. Or you sacrifice everything and take enormous risks and risk that it actually doesn't work out, but to explore the adjacent possible, right? And to follow the voice that's telling you that it's time to move. And neither of them are easy, right? They're both like wildly impossible, and both can be like the, you know, the worst experiences of your life. But one of them is guaranteed to kill you, and the other one is not.
This is brilliant, because I think I just found the title for this episode, which is Tom Morgan, the voice that's telling you to move.
Oh, shit. I am not legally liable.
Right. No, but I think it's fantastic, because you do want, on the one hand, you want the voice that's like, hey, you could move, just like check out these other things, right? Like the curiosity Sherpa. On the other hand, you want it to come from somebody who can firsthand tell you that, listen, this isn't easy, or, you know, like, I mean, it's not riskless in the sense that, like, yes, you you are coming down from that local peak, and like that means giving up things that's uncomfortable. Like you mean maybe giving up money or status or like, you know, relationships. Like, and you talk about like destroying your old models a lot. Like it involves the destruction of things that you treasure, or letting go of things that you treasure, and it's not trivial by any means. And then there's always the fact that, like, I struggle with that, where like, you know, time passes, and like you can explore in an my fear would tell me that, well, I can explore a lot of valleys, and like, is that really, like, you know, sometimes the dead end job and the drinking, maybe that wasn't such a bad idea. I'm like, no, I know this isn't true, but I still hear the voice, right? And so I think you need the support of other people to help you navigate that process. Like, doing it by yourself, I think is yeah, at least for me, it strikes me as very treacherous if you don't have people who are like, you know, not telling you what you do, but like just who are kind of there so you can get it out of your head. And so the voice that's telling you to move.
Well, to talk about voices in your head, the thing about voices that is very interesting is the conceptualization from McGilchrist that the left hemisphere has language and sexy language, right? Good syntax, really articulate words. And because those are the things that we use to manipulate the world, like a predator. The predator's tools in the modern era are language, right? Because it gives us power, which is a really interesting conceptualization. Abstractions give us power. Sorry, abstractions are Moloch. And you know, the bargain you make to Moloch, who is the Canaanite god of child sacrifices, throw whatever you value most onto the furnace and I will grant you power. And whatever you value most often is your time, right? You will sit there in an office dying in return for your salary, right? And that literally is the sacrifice that you choose to make. But that voice often is very loud and incredibly rational and persuasive and articulate. The problem is that the right hemisphere, which is connected to truth, which is the voice of the shaman, often sounds kind of cliched because it's speaking the truth inarticulately, but it's also very quiet. It's quiet in most people, like literally. And so like you have this conceptualization of the voice of conscience, which often is like a physical sensation because your right hemisphere is also connected to your heart center and is connected to your body in a different way. And that you'll start to get signals from your body and this tiny little voice that nags at you being like, you're in the wrong place, you're in the wrong place. But it's very easy for the voice with a million times less information to be like, here are these incredibly well-rehearsed rationalizations for why you should not do that, which is another reason why these slack practices are useful, because anything that puts you in your body gives you just a higher probability of getting clear signals. To give you a precise example from my own life is that before the thing that kicked off the awakening process and the breakdown simultaneously was I was told by a functional medicine doctor to go on a 30-day elimination, or maybe three-month elimination diet. So a serious elimination diet, which is...
elimination diet, eliminating what?
Everything. It's the least fun thing in the world. You basically... I did a year-long certificate in functional medicine to kind of get a better understanding of these things. And with no disrespect, there's an enormous amount of nonsense in this field, and I'm not a nutritionist. But like, it basically, you just cut out all the fun stuff for a very long period of time. And the problem with the fun stuff like sugar and alcohol and caffeine to a lesser extent is that like it's just disrupting the signals. And if you cut those out for a long time, if indeed you're getting signals from your gut, if indeed you're getting signals from your body, you're just going to hear them a little bit more clearly because you've got to give that right-hand voice more of a fighting chance.
Are you saying me eating a box of cookies is I'm trying to not hear that voice that's trying to tell me something over the crunching sound? I'm joking, but like yes, I.
Well, this is a time to demonstrate massive hypocrisy because I eat like crap and I drink a lot. So like.
Well, you're coming out of the valley right now. You deserved a little bit of a reward. Well, Tom, this was fantastic. I really enjoyed it. I always learn a lot from you, and I really appreciate that you're taking the time to share.
It was a delight. Thank you for having me.